Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
This is the Progressive Britain History Project, part of the Progressive Britain Podcast. In each episode, we look at different aspects of the Labour Party's past with the aim of promoting a clearer understanding of its contested history, perhaps busting a few myths on the way, introducing some new ways of thinking, and making connections between Labour's history, its present, and future. I'm Laura Beers, Professor of History at American University in Washington, D.C. I'm here with my co-host, Stephen Fielding, Professor of Politics at the University of Nottingham. Hi, Steve.
Hello.
And Dr. Emma London, Senior Lecturer in History at the University of Malmo in Sweden, who's going to talk to us today about one of my favorite topics, women in politics, and specifically the position of women within the Labour Party. Emma has a PhD in History and Politics from Birkbeck and is currently writing a social history of parliamentary gender quotas in Britain, Europe, and the South African ANC. Before academia, Emma worked as a journalist with the BBC and Condé Nast and previously hosted her own podcast, so is used to the gig. Welcome, Emma, and thank you for coming on our podcast today.
Thank you for asking me.
The current Conservative leadership contest between former Chancellor Rishi Sunak and Foreign Secretary Liz Truss has once again brought the topic of gender and politics to the fore of political debate. Truss is currently an odds-on favorite to win the election amongst the Tory party membership. And if she does emerge victorious at the end of the summer, that would make her the third woman to lead the Conservative Party and the third female Conservative Prime Minister. Both Tory supporters and political commentators across the political spectrum have made much of the fact that their party has elevated three women to the top post, while the Labour Party has yet to elect a woman leader. This isn't for lack of women running for the top position. Women have, of course, stood for the Labour leadership, including Yvette Cooper and Liz Kendall in 2015, and Lisa Nandy and Rebecca Long-Bailey in 2020, but have never secured the top post. So I thought that we could start off by asking, so what? What, if anything, does it signify that there's never been a woman Labour Party leader? The Labour Party has proportionally more women in elected office at all levels than the Tories, thanks in large part to their controversial policy of introducing all-women shortlist in 1997. In fact, the parties had to suspend the use of all-women shortlist at the parliamentary level on the grounds that the policy would discriminate against men, as their parliamentary Labour Party is now more than 50% female. The current Shadow Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, is the first woman to serve in that post, and were Labour to form a government after the next general election, might potentially be the first female chancellor. Labour was the first party to elect a woman to the cabinet, Margaret Bonfield as Minister of Labour in the 1929 government, and the second female cabinet minister, Ellen Wilkinson, about whom I've written a biography, I had to get that plug in there, is also a member of the Labour Party. So what, if anything, does it matter that Labour has not yet had a woman leader? Emma?
Well, I think it's a really interesting question, and it's a really big, I've got so many unstructured thoughts on this, but it's a really big issue, and I think it's quite an embarrassment for Labour at the moment, and I think it's an embarrassment for the women of the Labour Party, and that is a big problem. I mean, you plugged your book, Laura, so I should probably say that I helped research Rachel Reeves' latest book, which is called Women of Westminster, and we were interviewing lots of current and former MPs from all parties, But with that was during the time that Theresa May was Prime Minister, and a question that came up throughout with whoever we were talking to, whatever party they belonged to, was the question of whether Labour was ever going to have a female Prime Minister or a female leader. And quite a few people asked Rachel if she wanted to be it, which was quite fun. She dodged that question very diplomatically every time in slightly different ways. But I think the embarrassment is quite an important issue. I mean, I study political organisations from a social history angle, so I'm interested in what makes people tick and what makes people do what they do, the particular way in which you have to operate if you're part of a political party who seeks power, the sort of women's organising behind the scenes to kind of gain access to and execute like power, and it's, you know, it's something that holds a lot of people back. And I think one of the things that we should talk about during this podcast is like the personal cost of being the person to put your head above the parapet and say, no, hang on, I want to stand for leader, I want to be the leader, I can do this, because that has also been quite controversial. I mean, another thing that we should talk about maybe, or mention at least, is the fact that for Labour in particular, being a socialist party or a social democratic party, they also have this constant ideological battle with, you know, whether women get liberated by social democratic or socialist policy, or whether they need something else before that happens.
Steve, do you want to come in?
Well, I've got lots of unstructured thoughts too about this particular issue, because I mean, being on Twitter and during the course of the Conservative leadership campaign, which is obviously still ongoing, then that was something. I mean, Conservatives were saying it, but a lot of people in the Labour Party were saying it, and it's not a good look. It is quite an embarrassment at that top level. But as you say, you know, Laura, I mean, just over 50% of Labour MPs are women. And that's bound to get, I mean, that's from 2019, right? So a lot of them must be in very safe seats. So that percentage, possibly, certainly that number is going to increase. And that's twice the number that the Conservatives have. And I'm a member of a local Labour Party. And I know that for various, all positions, you know, delegate to the GMC, you know, all kinds of positions, there are certain percentages, you know, you've got to have at least half of women. You've got to have at least one woman in a particular role. And so there are lots of those things in place. And I just wonder, you know, it doesn't look good, but is anybody saying that there is a woman problem in the Labour Party that the Conservative Party either doesn't have or has somehow managed to just ignore and, you know, project these two, possibly three women into the leadership? I don't know what Labour could do to make it much more likely, other than having an all-woman shortlist, maybe, for leader, which, of course, isn't going to happen. So it's kind of like, it looks really bad, but everything else seems to be, I mean, you know, I can be told, there's always problems, so it will never be perfect. But just by not having a leader, a woman as a leader, it looks bad, but is it bad? I mean, is it actually bad? If the party has got the policies which Labour has, and of course they can always be improved. And I looked at the, not that this should then mean we can forget about it, but I looked at the latest figures for the gender divide in voting, and it's never been higher. I mean, you know, certainly amongst young women, 13%, young women, women under 35, that is, they vote Labour 13% more than young men in that age group. So, and overall, Labour's lead is something like 8%. So, if it doesn't look good, and it doesn't, and if it is bad, and it is, it doesn't seem to put off at least certain women voting for the party. But so yeah, it looks bad. But I'm not quite sure what else the party has to do. I mean, it can't guarantee that the next leader is going to be a woman. I personally, I'd be happy if Rachel Reeves was the next leader, but I suspect she won't be, but for reasons totally different to her being a woman.
Okay, so I'm going to take the unstructured thoughts that both of you guys have thrown out and try to impose some structure on them in terms of some talking points we might pick up. Because I think there are a few different issues here. One is what, you know, Steve's comment about gendered support for political parties and how that does or doesn't map onto women in positions of leadership, right? And so Britain has had, since Thatcher was in power, you've started to see a reversal, a narrowing first of the gender gap and then a reversal where women are more likely than men to support the Labour Party. And this is despite the fact that Thatcher was the first female prime minister and that the Tories have gone on to have now two and soon to be three likely women in the top position. Right. So is there a link between women in leadership positions and women's support for a political party? And if not, what does that mean? And that sort of leads into a second question, right, about whether it actually advances women's interests to have women in leadership positions, or whether it's more important to have policies that, or have a government in power that pursues policies that help women. And again, this was a conversation that really heated up first when Thatcher was prime minister. But I think there are also questions about political culture, right? And Emma really underscored the discomfort that a lot of women felt about the fact that Labour women felt that Labour hadn't had a woman leader. I heard Emma Thornberry on the BBC a couple of weeks ago being quizzed on this, and clearly you could hear the discomfort in her voice and the defensiveness as well, as she talked about, you know, the number of women in local council positions and sort of tried to hedge about why a lack of a woman leader wasn't an issue. But I do think this links into the question of quotas and all-women shortlists, which Emma, you've worked on, right? And whether in some sense, the fact that Labour has pursued these all-women shortlists has in some ways worked to its disadvantage, because the Conservatives can turn around and say, well, we look at women on their merits and we've promoted women to leadership positions because we see women, you know, not as women, but as qualified. And I've identified these qualified women who come to the top. Whereas Labour is so inherently misogynistic that it needs to impose these quotas in order to promote women, because otherwise women wouldn't be promoted. And the fact that in the last two leadership campaigns, you've seen two women versus one man, and in both the man has secured more than 50% of the vote in the final round, arguably seems to bolster that that Tory argument. So I guess that relates to this question of political culture, right? And whether the culture of the Labour Party is inherently masculine, and whether quotas have been brought in a sense to try to counteract that. And on the flip side, is the Conservative Party less inherently masculine? And if so, why? So Emma, because you're our guest, having thrown down those three very different kind of broad areas of discussion, I'll let you choose which we pick up the reins and run with first.
Oh, difficult. I think maybe I should just start by saying that the quotas, I mean, they were introduced because of a particular in the Labour Party, the women who worked to introduce the all women's shortlists. They very much used the fact that if women had swung to Labour in the 1992 election the way that men had, then Neil Kinnock would have been the Prime Minister. So that was very much a selling point, that we need to look like we represent women. And I think for many parties who enforce quotas around the world, and this is like a transnational social democratic movement from 1986, specifically there's a Congress motion at the Socialist International, this can get incredibly geeky, but there's, you know, it moves over the world in various parliamentary parties. And from that moment on, women do get elected and are more visible, and it does make a difference. And, you know, the female electorate moves left, at least in Great Britain as a result. But, or maybe not as a result, but at least contributing to the fact that women started voting for Labour, because they feel like, you know, Labour starts, the more women enter the Labour Party and the parliamentary Labour Party, the more they start talking about childcare, for example, which is, you know, something you definitely want to talk about if you want to win votes from women. So I think the reason the quotas exist is potentially also a reason why some of the work of the women in the Labour Party can feel as though it's enough. Because, I mean, really, if you have a party leader, of course, it's a very important office, but there's lots of people who contribute lots of policy and run various ministries if they're in power and, you know, various shadow positions when they're not in power. And I think, you know, it is a problem. The fact that they haven't had a female leader is a problem if it looks like a woman could never be elected because she is a woman. And I think that might be why this sense of embarrassment comes out. I mean, everyone, I think, would like to have had a female leader back in the 80s and 90s. But, you know, I'm sat in Sweden today, Sweden, which has enforced gender quotas in all parliamentary parties. I think we have about 7 or 8 or maybe even 9 parliamentary parties, all of them, bar the far right Sweden Democrats, enforce various kinds of gender quotas. And it was only in the autumn of 2021 that Sweden got its first female prime minister. So, you know, quotas in countries can kind of overshadow, you know, the big positions. And I mean, that was an acute national embarrassment on behalf of Sweden, looking really like, you know, Norway had a female prime minister in the 80s. So
I mean, Labour certainly historically has been a masculinist party. I mean, that's obviously been connected to the role of the trade unions and the fact that, you know, the world of work was, at least at some level, certainly at the unionised level, predominantly male and male in a certain way. You know, labouring unions, skilled, semi-skilled, you know, men that use their hands. I mean, that's kind of an old stereotype and a stereotype that was true of the Labour Party, that it did define its core business as increasing, you know, the power, the representation of trade unions that were predominantly male. I did a book, I'm not expecting anyone to buy it, so it doesn't really matter. It's no longer available. But I looked in the 50s and the 60s, and that was incredibly misogynistic. You know, you would get sort of people in mining constituencies where women would talk in Labour meetings and the men would talk over them. They would sort of be amused at the very idea that here's a woman who's going to talk about politics in one of our meetings was sort of almost amusing. So women had so many barriers to overcome, and they even had their own separate organisation that some people thought channeled them away from the centre of the Labour Party, and, you know, pat them on the head, they can do their little discussions, but it had no influence on the National Executive Committee. Now, the reason why I don't think that that's the case now within the Labour Party is partly because the labour market has changed, the trade unions have changed. And so, you know, those core unions, so they might have a rhetoric of militancy, which maybe brings with it certain sort of tropes of sort of manliness. But nonetheless, you know, there's a significant number of their own members. And now some trade union leaders, and for quite some time as well, have been women. So I don't know if Labour is now inherently masculinist in the way that the Conservatives would be seen not to be. It definitely was, and that was definitely a problem. And definitely the agency of certain women and certain men to actually challenge that has transformed the party. I mean, as I say, I'm a member of a ward party. I go to our general management committee meetings. And I mean, it's in South Manchester, so it's all pretty, you know, university lecturers, but it's a mix of classes. And I wonder whether that's inherently a masculinist organization in any sense. So I think I don't know that the problem is the culture of the party now, at least in certain parties, maybe ironically in those parts of Britain where Labour lost those seats, maybe some of those Labour parties, it may be more traditional in their outlook. But I think broadly speaking, if that's, I don't think that's the problem. I don't think that's a problem, but, you know.
So Emma, I want to let you come back in on this issue, but I would like, Steve, to come back to your, I'm in a South Manchester Labour Party and we don't see this kind of, you know, misogynistic political culture, because I think that does raise questions about which direction Labour is moving in, right? And whether it is a more urban, maybe less misogynistic, more cosmopolitan direction, or whether there is this kind of wistfulness to win back a red wall where the perception, perhaps wrongly, is that this more masculinist industrial culture is still predominant. And I'm not saying that that perception is accurate, but it might then impact the way that party members think about who should be leading the party and what direction it should be going in. Emma, you'd wanted to come in though on Steve.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I was thinking about is the whole question of, or issue of respectability and who, you know, like the this is maybe part my rambling thoughts at the beginning about how socialism plays a role in this. The fact that, you know, for several generations, up until like the 70s or even beyond that, for many working class people, it was, you know, considered a respectable thing to be able to afford to have a housewife, that your wife didn't go to work. And I mean, you know, even like socialist utopia, I mean, it's not, but Sweden, that was how the system was set up well into the mid 70s. It's actually one of the reasons why a lot of Swedish women went into politics to, you know, change laws to enable them to work. But it's still, you know, it's a big core. I don't think, I mean, that's not the case anymore. And I think if anything, all of these conversations about gender and electability in the last 30 years that have gone through the Labour Party, I think that has changed the tone. I think that, you know, misogyny is difficult to get away from. There's always going to be people who think women with small children should stay at home. And I think one thing we might want to look at is the people who have become female prime ministers of the UK. And, you know, how, you know, the age of their children, the kind of roles they have, Theresa May not having any children. But I think, you know, that there's lots of ideas about women and suitability. And, you know, this making women the laughing stock at local meetings is, you know, something that went on into the 80s and 90s. Women were there to make coffee or tea, to put up posters, to do like the groundwork, to support the men. And in the early welfare state, as you know, one of the things that Red Ellen was railing against Laura, the fact that, you know, that women were just supposed to be the stay-at-home caretakers of house and family. And, you know, for many women in politics, they had to make a choice whether they wanted to have families, and then they had to stay out of high office politics, or they went into high office politics and could not combine it with having families. I think Margaret Thatcher having a family is quite, you know, revolutionary, but her kids were old by the time she made it to 10 Downing Street.
And she makes that point very explicitly, Margaret Thatcher, right? That she sort of, you know, that she was a mother to them when they were young, and that she returned to, it's somewhat disingenuous, right? Because her political ambitions predated her motherhood, but she says, basically, I took a gap out of pursuing my political career to be a housewife. And as you say, these early female politicians were very much people who felt they had to make a choice. Right? Bonfield never marries and has children. Wilkinson never marries and has children. Jenny Lee marries but doesn't have children. Right? Barbara Castle's your kind of, you know, first real exception as a kind of heavy hitter, right? But
yeah, there's quite a big schism between that generation and the generation that comes afterwards. So it's sort of in the 70s when female MPs start having babies after they're elected, that's like a big problem. I think Lady Tweedsma had, I think she was a widow when she was elected, but she had young children and she used to just like hand them over to a respectable looking policeman when she went to vote. But she's a very, you know, a very unusual, but also very, you know, landed gentry from Scotland somewhere. And, you know, it's a kind of different thing. And then you hear the stories of women like Helen Hayman, who had a child when she was elected in 1974, she gave birth. She then had to come in like 6 days later. Someone, apparently, she told us when we interviewed her, called the police on her when she'd left her baby and the nanny in the ladies' members' room because they're not allowed to be there without the main member. So, you know, and that would have been a Labour Party member who would have, you know, like all of this, like a lot of tension because some people had to make a choice and some people tried to make it work. So, yeah, respectability, the role of women, and what we perceive women as being capable of, how we enable women to do what they're capable of. These are all questions that come up time and time again when you think about women in political leadership.
And I think it's very interesting that it hasn't come up with trust, right? I mean, it was one of the things when May was running and, you know, she was actually, it was used against her, right, that she wasn't a mother. And But no one has really talked about Truss's daughters or her family life. And maybe that is a sign of progress, right? I mean, in the same way that, well, Sunak's personal life for other reasons has been in the news, but not whether or not, you know, being a father could impact his abilities to execute his job as a prime minister.
No. But I think behind the scenes, I mean, in terms of the attacks that Penny Mordaunt received, there were questions about Penny Mordaunt's marital status, being single, because she was asked a question at least once on the national news about it. So I suspect that the Truss thing, because there's a whole a murder about her whole private life, to be perfectly frank, and that's she's being protected by press supporters. So that may be to do not necessarily with everyone's now really progressive about this, but she's being protected by her media supporters. But I just wondered about the Conservatives and their ability, the two women that the two women have done it. I mean, Thatcher, as I recall, was married to a millionaire, and she did have a nanny, didn't she, for her children? I mean, maybe I'm wrong on that. So that I'm not sure how many. I mean, some Labour women do come from quite well-off families, like Harriet Harman, and I think there has been a slight disproportionate number of Labour women who become MPs have come from relatively privileged backgrounds. But most Labour women who become MPs, they've had to, you know, they've like you were saying, they've had a lot of sacrifices to make and a lot of prejudices. Certainly, if we're talking about that earlier generation, I mean, When I did my book on the 50s and 60s, I mean, it was women MPs themselves who were telling other women who wanted to, you know, if you want to be an MP, you've got to have a hide like a rhinoceros. You've got to be like a man. You've got to be, you know, as aggressive, you know, you've got to be the man in that. So the sense that, you know, and now I think there are different ways that certainly Labour women MPs can be women. They don't all have to adhere to a certain kind of rhinoceros model. I mean, Stella Creasy obviously made a point about bringing her baby into the Commons chamber. And I think she makes a very big point about being a woman with young children and being an MP in a very, very conscious way. So I think that's all to the good. And I don't see Conservative women MPs doing anything like that.
And I think that's interesting as well, because I think, in, you know, the Parliamentary Labour Party, even before 2019, there were a fair share of maybe not fair, actually, that's the wrong word, but there was a large share of women still. And I think it sort of changes organisational culture, like organisational psychology, that you just have, you know, you talk about things. Like before we started interviewing, when I was doing that project with Rachel Reeves, you know, all the small talk is about like children and stuff like that. And I think that really changes. Whereas the Conservative women MPs are still a tiny minority and they have different rules to play with. You know, one of the things, an American political scientist called Karen Beckwith, who has come up with the concept of double militancy, that women in left-wing organizations suffer from this double militancy, that they're seen as being both like feminist and working for the women's cause, and then they're seen as working for the main cause, and that makes them sort of untrustworthy or like fifth columnists or whatever. Conservative women don't have that. They don't, you know, like they can be like Theresa May, feminist with a lowercase f. They don't, you know, it's not like barricades, it's not burning any brass, it's not, you know, causing any massive revolutions anywhere. So I think in that way they can be seen as more trustworthy. At the same time, the stereotypical like gender roles that they have to live with, I think, are probably still more constrained, and partly because they aren't that great in number. So this thing that we have at the moment where there are a myriad ways of being a Labour woman, I don't think that is the same case. I think for the Conservatives, that the women who make it to the top, they have, you know, husbands who make a great amount of money or are happy to stay out of the limelight, like Dennis Thatcher. I think Margaret Thatcher's kids had a nanny and they went to boarding school, but I think by the time she became Prime Minister, they were at university, both of them, I think, but I can, you know, something like that. They are of that age. So, you know, there's this, the image of Margaret Thatcher standing in 10 Downing Street cooking a meal for two and ironing Dennis's shirts for the next day. That's like, you know, she performs these feminine wifely duties, but she can do that in a capacity of this marriage with this one person. And then the kids are, you know, boarders or taken care of by someone else. But it's also like, that is a thing that is expected of conservative women. Diane Abbott told us that when she was elected in 87, and I think her son is born in 1992. So she was already an MP for about 5 years, and she had to bring him into the office on occasion. She had a family member from Jamaica who was looking after the baby during the weekdays. She's a London MP, so she obviously can commute from her own home, and she doesn't have the split home thing. That is another problem for primary carers who are also members of parliament. But she said that Nicholas Soame had looked at her in the lift once and said, "Oh, where is Nanny?" Because, you know, like, why don't you just like leave the baby with someone else? You pay someone to do it. And she's like, I'm an MP with not that great salary in those days, you know, an expensive office to run and all of that. So, you know, there are conventions and traditions that even though both parties are now, I mean, they're nowhere near as homogenous as that kind of crude characterization of rich Tories and middle class Labour Party members really is. And I think there is, you know, the traditions and the family structures might seem different, and that might help some conservative women, and it might really constrain some of the Labour women, at least historically.
So what do we think then that means in terms of a translation for how we understand feminism within the Labour Party, and how that differs from how conservative women would understand feminism? Right? Because you talked about what I've written about once as this sort of secondary contradiction for women, Labour women, right? You know, that they're socialist, but they're also feminist, but that their feminism is sort of traditionally meant to take second seat. And that was something that a lot of early Labour women really struggled with, but I think continues to be a tension in terms of women, Labour women who consider themselves feminist and how those two loyalties play out. But it's not only Labour women who consider themselves feminist, right? Margaret Thatcher famously says, "I'm not a feminist." She's very critical of, you know, these women's liberation movement, women in dungarees, as she sees them, who are very unfeminine. But Theresa May owned to what she believed was a sincere feminism, right? She was the founder, one of the co-founders of Women to Win. She was very concerned about increasing female representation in parliament and within her own party. And while Liz Truss hasn't spoken particularly about her feminism or lack thereof, right, as a junior minister, she starts out in the Ministry of Education with a brief for childcare. And so is presumably not uninterested or uninformed about the practicalities of balancing a career and childcare. But there isn't this same association of Tory women and feminism, right? And is that just mistaken, or does feminism mean something different for conservative women than Labour women? Does it necessarily mean something different, or is it just happened to mean something different? I mean, I'm sort of trying to be fair to the other side, right? But is it only Labour women who are feminist, or is feminism different if it's conservative feminism? Steve?
So I would say that this question is kind of like a subset of a broader question about different ideas of freedom. And conservatives have got a notion of freedom whereby it's a question of just getting rid of things that get in your way. To allow the individual to go, you know, as their talents take them, as far as their talents take them. Whereas with Labour, it's freedom that you need certain forms of help to realise your potential. So you need government to intervene either in the law or in terms of the state more particularly. So welfare, you know, welfare is very, very important and has always been an important part of Labour women's politics. The men had the wages. I mean, that was a classic divide. Men had wages, women had welfare. So the welfare state was very important in terms of Labour women and achieving some degree of equality, at least levelling the playing field a little bit. And so, I wouldn't want to deny that conservative women think, some of them think themselves as feminists, but their view is classically individualistic. Whereas with Labour, it's, well, people and specifically women, but other groups too, need government, need an intervention in different ways. And maybe it's no surprise that, in fact, I think this is what part of the explanation why Labour's got a big lead amongst certainly younger women relatively recently. It's because of austerity, the impact of austerity on their lives. I mean, it's a practical expression that younger women in particular need help, and that help is being denied. And Labour, you know, doesn't get elected, but it kind of is at least saying, you know, these things need to be restored.
Yeah, and I think I really agree. I think of conservative feminism as a sort of choice feminism, that you have the right to choose. You can choose to, you know, have a fantastic career, and you can choose to combine that with children if you want to, but, you know, there are certain sacrifices, but you can do it. It's like, you know, pulling yourself up by the bootstraps, I suppose, the feminist bootstraps. Whereas the Labour feminist, and feminism is such a broad church anyway, right? And within the Labour Party, it also goes like from however you want to distinguish it, like left to right or radical or, you know, like trans inclusive, or, you know, so many varying like individual opinions about and definitions of what feminism is. Liz Truss is quite a free marketeer, isn't she? So I suppose her feminism, if we're gonna make assumptions, I would assume that her feminism would be more of a kind of a free market feminism, that you can do it and you just have to get into the game and do it and kind of follow the rules in a way that maybe people on the Labour side would be like, well, we need to change the rules because this isn't fair. There is Theresa May. She definitely calls herself a feminist. And you're completely right with the Women to Win project, which is massively her. David Cameron gets a bit of credit for it because he put it in, you know, he adopted it when he became the party leader. But, you know, Amber Rudd came through Women to Win. She calls herself a feminist. But she, you know, like there are clearly issues with some of that feminism. And I think this is maybe another thing to think about, maybe not in this particular episode of the podcast, but at a later stage. Like, is it easier to be elected as a woman from the Conservative Party than a man with, you know, some sort of immigrant history, even though it's not his own, it might be his parents or grandparents? Because that is also like, is it easier now to be a woman than to be an ethnic minority in the party? And is that the same for Labour, or is that a different thing for Labour? I mean, racism is a real thing, misogyny is a real thing, and they sort of, you know, they move up and down these different levels. And I think there's a scary part of modern politics in which parties or party members who are able to vote for party leadership make assumptions about the electorate and who can be a leader based on assumptions about the electorate and who will, you know, look good in front of the electorate. And I think, ethnic minority women are the most abused on social media, or are sent the most abused on social media in British politics. And, you know, Rishi Sunak is a man, but he will also be subjected to a lot of racism and will have been throughout his life. So, you know, there are various interesting issues here that affect individuals in different ways.
And I mean, this is not the direction that this podcast is going in, but, you know, conservatives did make the point that their leadership contest was not just diverse in terms of the number of women standing, but also in the terms of the number of ethnic minorities who were vying for the top post. And you're right that there's an intersectionality there, which, I mean, Suella Braverman had other issues handicapping her campaign from the start, but, you know, being an ethnic minority woman, you know, didn't help those. And I guess it does lead back to that question of representation, right? And whether the Labour Party, the issue of not having a woman at the top might have to do with perceptions of how And as Emma said, you know, it's not really about what your voters think, but what you think they think, right? And does the Labour Party think that their voters want a man leading the party?
I mean, we're talking about a very small number of occasions where the Labour Party has had the opportunity to vote for a woman leader. I mean, if we just take it for like from nine, you know, Thatcher became leader of the Conservative Party through accident and dare, really. I mean, it's freakish how she became leader of the Conservative Party, right? So she was an accident, really, an aberration. So we can almost dismiss her. She's the great exception that proves no rule. But Labour's had a very small number of opportunities to elect a leader, really. And so, I mean, I just don't think that, I mean, maybe there are some people that think like that. I just don't meet them. And certainly when I was considering the merits, it was the fact they're a woman or a man was irrelevant. What's interesting, though, is how the issue can be used. I mean, this is something we need to be aware of, can be used in completely disingenuous ways. So I remember in the last leadership election, Ian Lavery, you know, one of Jeremy Corbyn's loudest, if nothing else, supporters, said in a speech how terrible it was that Keir Starmer looked like he was going to be elected leader. And this was he should stand down in favour of Rebecca Long Bailey, who, of course, was the continuity Corbyn candidate because she was a woman. And of course, that was completely disingenuous. So there are people that are going to use this in different ways. But broadly, I mean, I'd be surprised if it was a significant sort of element in certainly Labour Party terms that, she's a woman, therefore that's a problem. Because if nothing else, Margaret Thatcher, I think, demolished that as a thing. I mean, exceptional and an aberration she was. But I think that actually did make it easier for people to think about a leader in those as someone to become a leader or prime minister. I mean, I don't know. Maybe you've got sort of evidence that it is, but I just don't think so. It just hasn't happened yet for all kinds of reasons, which I don't think sexism is the most important one. I don't think, but I could.
I think you're completely right as well. It's just some of the kind of off the record conversations I've had with, among them, like political journalists who might be aware of, you know, how various newspaper proprietors are keen to portray certain women in particular, maybe, you know, like that it makes, I think the problem is more how easy they are to attack and that you want to build up some sort of defense ahead of reaching that point. But I think you're very right. And I think this is like, I mean, maybe we've just spent 42 minutes talking about something that could have been solved through an accident as well, like Margaret Thatcher, because I think, I mean, that is also really interesting. Would they have elected her as party leader if they hadn't thought that she was just going to be she was going to be there for like a year or two. She wasn't going to get up to much. I don't think they would have elected her. I think Michael Heseltine has said as much, that they would never have elected her if they'd known that she was going to stay for 12 years or however long she remained in her post. You know, like it's, you know, you never really quite know what you're getting when you vote for a party leader. But the fact that women of the Labour Party who have stood for leader have often had like their private lives run through in the press, all of these mistakes they make that become a big thing, how they neglect their children, how they send their children to private school and all of that. And I think, you know, it's off-putting, at least, to maybe not to the electorate, but it's off-putting for people to put themselves in that kind of vulnerable position.
So if it was just by chance, in some senses, that we got Thatcher, if it's not about misogyny within the Labour Party, but about kind of agendas within the press or other things that maybe have made it hard for women or few opportunities to rise to the top of the Labour Party, I guess that loops back to that one of the first questions that emerged from our kind of opening comments, which is, how important is it really? I mean, Steve flagged up the fact that since Thatcher was prime minister, the gender gap has narrowed and ultimately swung the opposite direction, where now women are more likely to support Labour than the Conservatives, vis-a-vis their male counterparts in the electorate. You know, this is at the same time that you have seen Theresa May as prime minister and now Truss likely to become the next prime minister. So is it really not about who's leading the parties, but about the policies they're pursuing? And what are the policies that the Labour Party over the last couple of decades has pursued that have made it increasingly comparatively attractive to women in the electorate? And can that be the ship that they sail forward into, you know, an election victory based on a female majority?
I think my main thing about what policy they pursued and what policy they probably should be pursuing is childcare. Because I think Labour has an electorate, or could at least appeal to an electorate, that would like to work. And, you know, that I don't live in the UK anymore, but I had kids and nurseries in London before I moved to Sweden. And, you know, we in Sweden, we pay like less than in a year than I would in a month in London. And we didn't have full-time childcare there. And we have two kids in full-time childcare here.
I'm living in the United States, Emma.
I know, I'm incredibly spoiled these days. But I think it's like, you know, like sort the childcare out. And it's such a massive debate right now. I think it really helped entice women in 1997. I think it's a good policy to have for them. It targets so many of their like key demographics and their key ideological positions. And then sometimes I think they should think about how they talk about it and how they talk about, you know, like that they're going to be hard on benefits and all of that. I think they, you know, they're trying to target people who read the Times, I suppose, with that sort of strategy. But, you know, push childcare, and I think you'll. You know, you stand a greater chance of winning than if, you know, the Conservatives don't seem to have an answer at the moment. Nothing I've seen from the bits I've seen of the Tory leadership, the debates haven't showed me anything that they have any answers to the childcare problem. And they might not even think that childcare is a problem because of like the reasons we were talking about before.
I once did, it's quite embarrassed. No, I'm not embarrassed, but I should be embarrassed. In 2010 for the election, I was given some money by Lambrini, the drinks company, that was trying to rebrand itself because it was very concerned that Lambrini kept popping up in the press, popular press, you know, teenagers getting drunk on Lambrini. So they were trying to sort of redirect attention and improve its brand image, because the women that actually drink Lambrini, I don't know if either of you have ever drunk Lambrini, it's a lovely drink, I'm not being sponsored by them anymore, but the women that did were working class women in their with children in their 20s, 30s and into their 40s or later, sort of not young but not old, and they did a survey of women who were working of that very demographic, and what did they want from politicians? They wanted clean hospitals, they wanted free dental care. They wanted something done about education, right? About their kids, right? There were none of those things politicians were talking about, and none of them are they, you know, free dental care. Where's that gone, right? So I would actually, I mean, you know, I'd agree with Emma that I would have said childcare, right? But the thing is, and I don't want to go against. I mean, this is the hard faced sort of politics of things. One of you said that when quotas was first talked about in 92, it was an electoralist argument. I mean, clearly it was feminist, but the feminists were using an electoralist argument, i.e. if only women had voted to the same extent as men in 92, we would have won it. Labour doesn't need to do that anymore. Labour's lead with women, certainly younger women, is bigger than it's ever been. Its problem is with young men and with older women, right? Because the gap between men and women diminishes with age, so that there's no difference between the over 60s between men and women. So if Labour's got, ironically, if Labour's got a problem with women, it's with older women. I mean, I'm not saying it shouldn't do those things, that, you know, but it's not going to really get so much of an electoral benefit. Or if it does, maybe it won't be, you know, diminishing returns. So it needs to address young men, whatever they're doing, but older women. And maybe that's where the WASPI women thing comes in. I mean, I was briefly, I did some brief canvassing in the last by-election, Wakefield. And one, I mean, it was bizarre. There was this very well-off older family, and the man down, there was a man and a woman, couple, and the man said, "I've voted Conservative all of my life, but I'm not going to vote for them until they do something about WASPy women, because my wife is a WASPy woman." And they'd all been, and they were going to vote Labour because of that issue. So maybe totally electoralist, do something about that, which I know it's somewhere there or thereabouts. Whether they resolve from it, I don't know. But that's what I would say. If you're thinking purely as an electoralist thing, Labour is an electoralist organisation.
I think, though, I just want to make a point about maybe childcare being an issue for young men as well. because young men also have families, and a lot of these young men also struggle to pay their childcare bills and would maybe be better off as families if both parents could work full time. But I think you're very right. And I think it'd be quite interesting to brainstorm what drink should pay for the next bit of research to target young men. I feel really out of date on that one, but go to any student pub and I think you'll find quite a few.
And maybe that's the argument for time, right? I mean, Labour has always presented itself as the coming party and the future. And maybe as the demographics continue to shift, you know, it's been the coming party for over a century now, but maybe as our pensioners age out of the electorate, this will finally be the Labour's moment here. So on that optimistic note for Labour, thank you so much, Emma, for coming on today. And Steve and I will be back in your feeds in a couple of months after the recess. And enjoy your summers.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.